He loves automation, he loves sensing, and he's going to talk about what we may be able to do in controlled environment agriculture to make it more efficient, more automated, and hopefully more cost effective. George?
Thanks, Mark. Do you have a pen in mind?
No.
I'll stand up if you
Excellent. Thank you, and thank you for having me here. Thank you for sticking around to hear what I have to say. So I am I'm a bit of an outlier on this panel. I don't grow plants. I don't really know how to grow plants. I know a lot of people who grow plants, and they've taught me a lot of things, but they haven't taught me actually how to grow them myself. A little anecdote, I was involved in this project to do some irrigation control with Mark and others, and we decided we needed a little test bed in our lab to be able to test out the hardware. So we set up a little system, we went out, we got some lights, one of the growers was growing things in perlite in bags, so we set that up on a bench, and we got some pumps and some irrigation, and we decided to grow zucchinis and peppers, and we planted them in the thing, and got them to sprout up, and we were really proud of it. Our colleagues at Carnegie Mellon were excited about the fact there were green things growing. We felt really good about this, and shortly after that, we had a meeting for the project at Carnegie Mellon, and so we brought all the plant scientists and the growers down to see our stuff. And the engineer, David Kohenbosch, who put this together, was like, yeah, this is great. We've got zucchinis, and we've got peppers, and it's really good. And one of the growers, nice guy, as nicely as he could say it, he said, actually, those are the peppers, and those are the zucchinis. So that's where we're coming from here. I want to pick a couple of things to talk about. There are many, many possible topics, but as Mark mentioned, automation is one of the things that's very close to my heart. And I see a lot of places for automation in these types of systems, and there's a lot of reasons to get rid of the people, right? The people take up space, the people bring in diseases, the people bring in this random factor, there's safety issues, there's lighting issues, we've heard about those all along. You think of automation as being grabbing the plant and harvesting it, but there's actually a whole bunch of different things. There's, you know, information gathering, checking on the plants, seeing how they're doing. There's environmental control. I think we can automate a lot of these things. And then the second thing I want to talk about is this idea of matching the plant to the environment. And this sort of goes both ways. You can breed new kinds of plants to fit the environment you have. We can, if you're in a controlled environment, you can make the environment be all different things to match the plant you have. You can look at both together. And I think some of the automation technologies we have can help. So one of the other things that's different about my talk versus some of the others is I'm going to talk about things we haven't really done yet in this domain. I think I want to lay out some technologies that exist, have been developed in other places, and I think can have a lot of impact here. So when I think about automation, really what I'm talking about is robotics. And when I talk about robotics, really what I'm talking about is general purpose robotics. Okay, there's a lot of automation systems that are out there to do a specific task, and they do it very well. But the thing I work towards are these general purpose machines. So here's this beautiful cartoon I found on the internet of a robot farmer, right? And this, you know, it's a piece of art, but it sort of captures the thing that drives many robotic scientists, which is this machine. I mean, it looks like a person. That's kind of an accident. I think the fact it looks like a person is more limited imagination on the part of humans. But the real thing about this is a robot farmer, but it's not a machine that was designed to be a robot farmer. It was a machine that was designed, and one of the things that it can do is be a farmer. And you can tell just by looking at this. It's using tools. It's carrying bags around. This thing could, in addition to being a farmer, it could be a nurse. It could work in a factory. There are a lot of different things it could do. So when I think about automation, I'm pushing towards this, and I think agriculture is an application area, which is very different from wanting to automate specific activities that go on in agriculture. So sometimes you want to just build the automation system, more traditional automation system. Other times you want to go for robots. I always want to push the robots forward. So let me give you an idea of sort of where robotics are right now. This is some footage from the Carnegie Mellon team in the DARPA Robotics Challenge, which was this challenge that DARPA put on. They put together this series of tasks that were all related to disaster relief. This was motivated by the Fukushima incident and the idea that, you know, we want to get people into this disaster scenario. These robots are going to have to do this list of things. Robots in the competition, they needed to do things like drive a car, get out of the car, walk a certain distance, turn a valve. And, you know, with this particular robot, there were 23 teams that competed. We came in third. This particular robot, several millions of dollars to develop. One of the dirty little secrets that roboticists use all the time, and some of you probably guessed this already, is that this video is sped up by like a factor of 10, because it would be really, really boring to watch. One of the DARPA program managers said that this was a revolutionary event for robotics because it made watching robots go from being like watching paint dry to being like watching grass grow. So we're making some strides. But you can see the kinds of things this can do, and you can also imagine the kinds of things it can't do. And when you think about that robotic farmer I showed on the previous slide, we're a long way away. And it's going to be a long, long time before this kind of automation can have an impact in the kinds of situations and controlled environments that we're talking about now. But I think there are some things we can do. But I'll start with another example of things that are hard. So when we think about robotics, there's sort of three things we can give you. We can get around, we can manipulate things, and we can gather information. It turns out that manipulation is the hardest of these. Here are a few examples of some modern research manipulators that are doing pretty well. The one in the upper left-hand corner is a Herb robot, another CME robot that's famous for being able to separate an Oreo cookie. And it does it, and you should go check out there's a really nice video online of it working out. But, you know, when it separates the Oreo cookie, it's a painful process to watch, right? So the manipulation is there. We can do these interesting things, but when you compare it to what you'd really want to have happen in an agriculture environment where you have to grab and handle plants, this general purpose manipulation is a long way away. So sometimes in this game, you get things just by waiting, and I think that in the manipulation, especially the general purpose manipulation game, it's too early to try to push this into these applications. Now, there are also many systems that are specifically designed for agricultural automation, and they're very sophisticated. Again, there are great videos online, and you can go and look at them. The Demtech robot, the Agrobot strawberry harvesting robot, these are machines that work very well. They will only ever do one thing. That strawberry harvesting robot is never going to do anything other than harvest strawberries. Or it might harvest a very similar looking crop grown in a nearly identical system. But it's not going to harvest your lettuce in your vertical farm. So there's a business calculation to be made there. I mean, you can easily spend millions of dollars developing one of these machines. And if it's a limited application and you only need three of these machines in the world, it's probably not worth it to develop them in the first place. However, people do it, and if you want automation now, it's a matter of pretty straightforward engineering. If you can afford the development costs, you can get a machine that does whatever you want. We'll only ever do that thing. So it's worth talking about robots that fly. This is a different kind of robot. You may have seen these. There's hundreds, thousands all over everywhere you look. There's a robot that flies. Now, when we look at flying robots, you give up a lot. The mobility of a flying robot is fantastic. You don't have to worry about what the floor looks like. You can get around very easily. But you can't carry much, and you definitely can't touch things. So the idea of using a robot like this to, you know, pick lettuce is just ridiculous. I mean, Amazon talks about drone delivery of, you know, a toothbrush or something. Sounds crazy to me. Who knows? I might be wrong, but I can't believe that, you know, we're going to have drones delivering things via Amazon anytime in the near future. But these platforms are out there, right? You see them. There's footage a couple weeks ago about how drones were getting in the way of the firefighters that were trying to put out the brush fires in California because these drones are so cheap that hobbyists can afford to have them and fly them in the way of firefighters. So they're around, there's lots of different kinds of them, so we should think about how to use them. And they have great uses in agriculture. So Ria Sugiura, who's a visitor in our lab, comes from the Hokkaido Agricultural Research Center in Japan, has done a lot of work with using these drones to model and understand what's going on in crops on a regular basis. So this is a drone he put together in Hokkaido, and The basic idea, this is sort of, I'd call this a semi-autonomous application. A human pilot has the drone take off, and once it gets to a certain height, they send it to a series of GPS waypoints. They take pictures from the air. In this particular case, they have a nice camera, but it's just a regular camera that you would, you know, buy to take vacation photos with. So if you do that, and you do it on a regular basis every day or every week over the course of a growing system, you can put together some really interesting data products. So this is sort of the first thing that jumps to mind. You can fly over this crop. You can register all these individual pictures together to get one big picture of the field. You can see how things change over the course of a season. You can look at this comprehensive view of what's going on. You can also, using a technique that's called structure for motion, reconstruct the 3D structure of the thing that you're looking at. Right, you have this series of places where you flew around and took pictures, this bunch of features in the environment that you see, you set up this big math problem, there's a bunch of equations, a bunch of unknowns, you solve for the unknowns are the positions of the places you saw, and the positions of the camera when it took the pictures. And as a result, with this inexpensive sensor, with this camera, we can develop these really nice 3D models of things that you get just by flying by. So there's no expensive GPS system required here. All you need to do is get the camera around and take some pictures. And so you can imagine what this might do for looking at plants, checking on plants. This is a system that's inexpensive to operate. It's the software behind this is not all that sophisticated, and you can generate some really, at least they're at least pretty pictures, and now figuring out how to use them is the next step. So if you think about taking this, and well, I'll just let this movie play the rest of the way because it's kind of cool. These are soybeans, by the way. So you've got this combination of space and time in all three dimensions. You've got all this information captured in one place at a very low cost. Oh, let's see if I can get it to go to the next slide. I can't get the movie to change, so we'll just wait till it finishes running. And so this is a combination of the 3D and the temporal part all combined together. So you can imagine doing this in a production environment, using this to, for example, detect outliers. If you know what the crop should look like over the course of a growing cycle, and you could collect this information every day and you could compare what's actually happening to your nominal, you might be able to detect problems really early on. So now hopefully I can go to the next slide. Hopefully. Well, maybe it'll come up. The next thing is that what you'd really like, so that drone that he was using is about this big, which probably isn't very applicable in sort of indoor environments. But there are versions that will fit in your palm. They're much more limited in what they can carry around computationally and from a sensor point of view. But cameras are also, high-resolution cameras are very small and very cheap. The kind of camera that's in your cell phone that takes up this little tiny corner right here can be used to do the kind of modeling that's there. Here we go. Okay. So here's a picture of a small one with a nickel next to it. You can see it flying around in Rio's office there. And we can do the same kinds of modeling. And I'll show this next video, which gives you a little bit of an idea of what's going on computationally behind this modeling. So he's got this little drone. This is like a $100 piece of hardware. It's got a $10 webcam on it. And it's flying around his office, and it's finding features of things in the environment that are visually interesting. And as it flies around, it logs those features, and It keeps track of where they are, it keeps track of where the camera is, and we'll see, as you can see as it flies around, this sort of ghosty white stuff are the visually interesting points and where they are in three dimensions. And as you fly around, you get more and more detail. The camera is gathering lots and lots of information, and you're populating this map, this model of the world, and it's getting better and better as things go along. In a second here, you'll see the perspective rotate. So you can start to resolve, now as a smart human, you can start to resolve what's going on here. You can see the file cabinet, you can see the piece of the chair, you can see the little rails that hold up the shelves, you can see the bits of equipment on a shelf. So we're very good at looking at information like this and figuring things out from it. However, this is also a ton of information. I mean, we're talking about gigabytes and gigabytes of data. When you start to look at just data storage alone for this kind of thing, it gets very difficult just to store it. What you really want to do when you get to automation is not only generate this model and store the data, but you want to automatically analyze it. Because if you have to have a person go in and look at this, that's really not that much better than having the person go up and get their eyes directly on the crop. So here you can see the model's complete. And this is sort of the underpinnings of those colored 3D models I showed before. And you can take this, and now that you've got this 3D model, you can paste the color on top of it and get those sort of photorealistic representations. So you can imagine little drones flying around collecting information. And this is something that we haven't done yet, but I think we're ready to do now. And I'd really like to try this soon. There's a little bit of a challenge. If you look at the picture there on the left, is a grower that we work with in Maryland, and there's going to be a challenge from the robotics side in getting that little drone to fly around. So it can fit in between the spaces, but there's a lot of stuff there. There's a lot of wires and poles and things like that the drone's going to have to get around. This is a problem I think we can solve pretty easily. And the good news is that the drone's so cheap that I'm not afraid to crash a few of them into these poles. While we figure out how to do it. So I think that this ability to model environments like the one shown in this picture here is something I'm really dying to try. Okay, so now we can get a little bit into how you, once you've gathered the information, what you can do with it. Because the pretty pictures are nice, and it's fun to look at those movies, and as a smart human, you can figure out what's going on in them, but we really want to get the human out of there altogether. So this is some work done by Steve Nusky, who's another scientist in our group. And he has developed that red box that's hanging off the box of the back of this tractor, or this AGV that is taking pictures. This is in a vineyard, and he takes pictures. He's got a special lighting system and everything, and he's driving down. And the application here is crop load scouting. So you're looking at green grapes on a green background. It seems like a really hard problem, but Steve has figured out the computer vision to do this. So this can happen in real time as you're driving along. And you can drive along and look at the vines and find the grapes, and even then process that. You know where you were when you drove, so you can make the map, like the map over on the left, and keep track of what's going on in your field, where the good parts are, where the bad parts are. I'm going to try to switch the movie before it ends. All right, excellent. That one worked. Here's another example of doing a similar thing in apples. Now, apples is a little bit harder because it's an actual 3D canopy, and so it's hard to tell if there's something occluded behind a leaf. And so what Steve does here is he does the processing of the images like in the grape detection, but then he also builds one of these 3D models and starts to use that 3D model to reason about what's going on there. Right? So if you see a little bit of something that might be an apple, but it's buried way back in the canopy and you can confirm that it's back in the canopy, then it's probably an apple. If you see something, a little bit of something that might be an apple, but it's out on the front of the canopy, well, if it was an apple, you'd see the whole thing, and so you don't count that one. The other thing that this does is because you drive up and down both sides of the crop in this case, building the 3D model allows you to figure out which apples you saw from both sides so you don't double count things. So the specifics of what you do is less important, I think, than the general idea, which is that we can gather this information, we can create this 3D model, and you can start to imagine creating computer programs that analyze it and pull out the information you actually want. Right? A grower, why does he care about how many apples he has? Well, there's a lot of reasons. One of them is that he sells his apples before he picks them, so he needs to know what he has there. But there are, physiologists who know how many square inches of leaves you want per apple, and if you could actually gather this information, then you can improve management as well. One other bit of technology I'll just throw out there, sort of in this general realm of monitoring things, is the idea of using wireless sensor networks for monitoring and control. And this is something that I worked on as part of this SCRI funded grant called MINDS with Mark. This was led by John Lee Cox at the University of Maryland. And in that, we developed this system where you could take these wireless nodes that are battery powered, put them out in the environment, they could connect to a bunch of different types of sensors, and we learned how to use them, and in particular to do irrigation control. But I think that as a monitoring system, this is a much more general purpose platform. We can gather information, we can make control decisions and propagate that out there. So this makes environmental monitoring more flexible, less expensive, and it makes the control more flexible and less expensive as well. Okay, so a quick summary of automation and where we are. You know, in terms of mobility and manipulation, my goal and the goal of the robotics community is to have this general purpose capabilities that can do that. That's way, way off. That's science fiction. But science fiction is useful because it helps us figure out where we're going. Right now, the things that are, you know, mechanization, the types of application-specific automation is available and can be developed, but you need to think very carefully about whether or not it's worth developing because it's application-specific. And as the application changes, you'll have to develop new machines. On the sensing side of things, today we're in a much, much better place. We can use robots to collect data sets that are of resolution and scale and fidelity that we've never seen before. And we're just figuring out how to use that, but I think there's lots of opportunities to use that, both in the management and in other aspects, which I'll get to in a second. Some work has been done towards interpreting that data, right? And that's where I think the big advance we need to make next is now that you've got this massive amount of data, more data than you could get someone, talk someone into sitting down and looking at, how do you automatically process that to get to the actionable item that you actually need to act on? And then the final thing is that wireless in situ sensing is there, it's ready to use, and there's a lot of different things we can do with that as well. All right, so I think the big challenge here, we've got these tools, we've got some things we can do, and so the question is now, what do we do with it? And, you know, part of the reason I'm here is because I'm on this perpetual quest to figure out what to do with this next. In sort of the specific area of sensing manipulation, you'll notice the top bullet on both of those is find the problems to solve, right? We've got these technologies. They've been developed. Our society has paid a tremendous amount of money and invested a tremendous amount of resource into developing these technologies. And they're being used in other places, but I think they can have great impact here, and it's, you know, our responsibility to figure out how to use them to solve the kinds of problems that people in this room think about. A good problem to solve means something that's useful and profitable, but it also means something that you can actually solve with minor modification to the existing technology. And it really takes a partnership to find those problems, because I know what's easy to do, you guys know what is important. And it takes a long time and many, many conversations, oftentimes over adult beverages, to find those things, but it's definitely worth looking for them. In the sensing domain, I think that sort of problem to solve, the immediate one I think we want to solve is useful features to extract, right? So Steve Nusky can see green grapes on a green background. That's fantastic, but that means absolutely nothing to anyone doing controlled environment agriculture, right? So what are the kinds of things when you look at that field of lettuce, What is it you're looking for, right? And can we pull that out? Are there features in those images, in those 3D models we build, that can be used to help you make better decisions? The other thing is to find useful relationships, right? So there's this approach where you want to understand what the relationship is between the lighting you apply or some environmental condition you apply and the ultimate yield of that crop. Well, we can collect a lot of data. And if you have a lot of data and there's a relationship there, there are tools that can be used to find that relationship. And once you find that relationship, then you can exploit it, right? And if it's a solid enough relationship, it's predictive, and you can use it to adjust the environment or adjust what you're doing in the management. And you can understand or at least have a halfway decent prediction of what's going to happen when you do that. So I think those are where the sort of the data processing, machine learning, computer vision, these are the problems we're looking, that we have great tools for, and I think there's potential to have them apply them in this case. One general problem I'll just hit on very briefly is the idea of matching the plant to the environment, right? So this is sort of far stuff out, but there's a couple different ways of thinking about this. The first one is to match the environment to the plant. So you have a plant, and you make the environment do what the plant likes best. And that's exactly what controlled environment agriculture is about. This is sort of an optimal environmental control. And here in environment, I'm including everything, the irrigation and the nutrients and then the environmental parameters around the plant. In the limited experience I have working with these systems, it's not that difficult to make the environment have whatever parameters you want it to have. What's difficult is knowing what those parameters should be. So in irrigation control, really, it's not that hard to get the soil moisture to be at some level. What's hard is knowing what level you should have it at. So I think that's the way to approach that problem is how do we figure out what good environments are for these plants? There's a couple of different approaches that we've seen from earlier work. There's an approach I call the experimental approach. This is some work by Mark and his group. And they recognize that with these relatively inexpensive soil moisture sensors, you can accurately control the volumetric water content in a pot. And they then did this very systematic, very careful series of experiments to understand the relationship between that water content and how much water you were using, how much water was leaching, what the plant was doing, and they built up this knowledge base of how to use this idea, right? So it was easy to make the volumetric water content be 35%. That's an easy thing to do. What's hard is to understand what that 35% is going to get you in terms of plant quality and in terms of savings of water and money. An alternative approach is what I call the modeling approach. And in this approach, you have some sort of model of how your plant's going to behave. And you use that to make a decision. So this is another irrigation control problem. And in this case, you put a bunch of sensors in the environment. You feed them into a transpiration model for the plant. You use that to estimate how much water the plant has used, and then your control law is very simple. You just replace the water that was used. And this is some work that was led by Bill Bowerly on our project, and I found very interesting. There's some hidden things going on there, though. It looks all automated, but then you realize there are all these parameters that are in the model that have to be measured and set properly in order for this model to work. And right now, this is done manually. Graduate students go out and measure the things, or you hire someone to work at the farm and count the leaves on the trees, and that's great for a research project, but it's not so good for any kind of production system. But I think we have a potential solution to that. And you can imagine now with the things I've shown you before, low-cost data collection system, flying around, looking at the tree, generating a 3D model, extracting the relevant features that you care about, which are things like, you know, height and leaf area. You can imagine, right? If you can look at something and say, oh yeah, these are the features I want to pull out of that, it's actually pretty easy for a computer vision guy to come in and say, all right, you give me the model, I'll tell you how wide the tree is or what color the leaves are or how big the leaves are. If you can vision, if you know what the feature is, it's pretty easy to pull it out. So you know, there's some possible next steps which are sort of even further out. I really like this idea. This is a crazy idea, but I was talking to a guy at Google about doing this. He wants to set up hundreds of little growth chambers with plants in them. And it's not that expensive to build a little growth chamber now. With things like the sensor network technology we have, you can easily gather and control the environment in this small area, so you just set up as many of these things as you can fit. You put a plant in each one, or a bunch of plants in each one. You try out a whole bunch of different environmental variables. You collect all that data. You get this massive database that, again, no human being is ever going to want to look at or have the capacity to look at. But there are analysis techniques and machine learning algorithms that can look for relationships in there. And especially if you suspect there's a relationship there, the machine learning guys can find it if it's really there. And so I think that this is, this sounds like a crazy idea, but I think if you want to talk about finding the optimal environment for a plant, this is a really good way to do it, because what's going on in the plant, to me, seems complex enough that the models, the first principles models that drive that plant, aren't accurate enough to really predict it. I think you have to do it in a more experimental way. I think that there is a lot of room for using model-based approaches and identifying models where you think there's a relationship, you have a reasonably good estimate of what it is. I think we can use that and develop the systems. You take your model, tell me what you need to measure for that model, and we'll figure out a way to measure it. And then we can feed the model, and you can use that to predict conditions from that. Okay, the flip side of the problem is to match the plant to the environment, and this becomes now more of a breeding problem. And I think this seems to me, especially as an outsider looking in, to be an extremely important problem for controlled environment ag, because you're using plants that have been developed over thousands of years for completely different settings. The idea is to use this kind of information collection that we have. We can collect these massive data sets with lots of very detailed information and use them to accelerate breeding. And I'll just say a little bit about a new program I'm just about to start. This program is so new we don't even have a clever acronym for it yet. But it's a sorghum breeding program. It's led by Steve Kresovich at Clemson. And the basic idea, from my perspective, is to, in these sorghum breeding plots, collect a lot of information. So we're going to have a couple of different kinds of robot platforms that drive around on the ground, one that has a set of sensors that look up close and get you very high resolution information about what the plant looks like. We'll look at multispectral data. We'll do laser scanning. We'll collect this massive data set that way. We'll have another robot on the ground that has a simple manipulator. So remember how I said manipulation is hard? Well, it is hard, but I'm taking steps towards actually doing it. So we want to make a simple manipulator that has that can clamp a leaf clamp onto a leaf and maybe poke a penetrometer into the stalk. So those robots will be driving around on the ground gathering data. There'll be an aerial robot that flies overhead and gathers data continually over the course of a growing cycle. We'll have an environmental sensor network that's measuring the environmental conditions at all times. We're going to get this massive data set. We have in this project, we have budgeted $300,000 a year just for data storage. We're going to be generating lots and lots and lots of data. And then we'll hand it off to this whole other team of people. So this data collection system becomes this little part in this much bigger cycle of using this information to accelerate the breeding, to select the germplasm, to figure out the relationships between the genetics and the environment and the phenotypes. The ultimate goal is to breed a better kind of sorghum as an alternative energy crop. So there's some obvious challenges if you wanted to bring this approach to CEA. The big one is that outside in these big crops we have a lot of space and we can use big powerful machines, and indoors you have much tighter mobility constraints, right? And those quad rotor air vehicles, they can get around. I've got no worries about their mobility, but they really can't do much of anything other than observe. So there are going to be some challenges in navigating the tight spaces. Of course, you need better feature extraction. But I think the biggest problem is sort of programmatic. How do you define this problem, right? If you wanted to have a breeding program that was going to use this type of high throughput phenotyping for breeding CEA crops, I think you need to figure out where the right domain is, get the right people together, build a team, design a program, lay out the problems you're going to solve, and then go out and get funded and do it. So I think that the just deciding what to do, figuring out how to do it, convincing someone that it's worth doing, those are the biggest challenges at this point. All right, so that's pretty much near the end of what I'm going to say here. Just to remind you, robotics is out there. There's lots of people playing with robots because they love them, because they want to use them to solve these general problems, and these technologies are going to be trickling as they mature into your domains. Manipulation is kind of the holy grail, but it's going to be a while before we have that. We can get around now, all right, especially aerial, but the thing I think that's the high impact thing we can do now is monitoring. Monitoring via aerial vehicles, monitoring via sensor networks, getting you that information. The challenge is what you do with the information. I think that the places where we can really start exploring and having impact in controlled environment ag is in the area of environmental control, right? How do we get the environment? How do we find the environment that matches what the plant needs? And in the high throughput phenotyping programs. And then, like as I've said a couple of times, I think the biggest challenge is to find the right problems, find the thing where it's exciting enough and important enough to go after to justify the expense to do it. And that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you, George. Do we have questions for George before I will ask all the speakers to come back up?
So the answer to the specific problem is no. Like I don't know of anyone who's used this kind of technology to do pest detection inside a greenhouse. There is some work in outdoor crops, and we've done ground vehicle deployed sensors, multispectral sensors and cameras to attempt to detect pests in apples. Hasn't worked all that well. It's a hard problem. And by the time you can detect them, especially in the apple industry, it's usually too late. But it's an area of active research. I think another thing you can do is sort of look indirectly. If you can monitor the health of the crop and catch early on the negative effects of the pests or whatever disease is coming in, I think that's an equally good approach. But again, by the time it's affected the plant, you know, the growers would really like to detect it before that.
One of the vendors as an exhibitor out here is analyzing volatiles or organic compounds. If that was able to be done in real time, then perhaps a drone could go focus in on where that particular problem may be.
Yes, that's exactly right. So people have brought that up. So we don't, I don't build new kinds of sensors. But if there's a sensor that can be deployed on one of these platforms, then we can get it to where it needs to be and to use it to take the measurement and then maybe even do some of the analysis that goes along with that. Good point. Yes?
George, in your career, is the application of your expertise to agricultural problems relatively recent, or have they been there throughout your career?
I've been doing it, you know, I've been interested in these problems for about 10 years out of about 20 years I've been doing robotics altogether. Right now I spend about, I don't know, maybe a third of my time in the agriculture domain. So.
Yeah. You're of course looking for applications.
We are always looking for applications, always looking for partners, definitely. Yes.
I'll say that we've been using drones in our greenhouses for a while. It's pretty much synonymous with crashing them in our greenhouses. And but I think that there's a lot of potential there, especially with indoor growers trying to get access to really high level.
Right. So when you use them, are they remote controlled or are they flying by themselves?
Remote controlled, not flying by themselves.
Right. Yeah, so the types of sensing that builds those beautiful models can also be used in real time to detect obstacles and avoid obstacles. So I can see how, especially there's line of sight issues inside too, right? The person probably has to walk around a lot while they're flying the drone. It'd be nice if you could just press a button and have it do a survey and avoid all the obstacles that are out there. And I think that's within reach. That's a relatively near term thing.
George, related to that, when you talk about a greenhouse or a controlled environment agriculture facility in general, drones are really cool, but why use a drone and why not simply have a camera or whatever sensor you have moving along a rail system? You have a lot of
existing infrastructure there that is already processing?
Yeah, I think if the infrastructure is there, things like gantries and rail systems are always much better from the operation perspective. There's the infrastructure expense of putting them in. If you're using infrastructure that's already there, then yeah. I mean, those drones, that little palm-held drone, I mean, that thing was literally $100. So it's hard to beat that $100 cost. Of course, there's some development that has to go along with it in order before it can become useful in the environment. But yeah, and you know, if you can, cameras, webcams now, you can get a good HD webcam for $7. So you could imagine putting up 100 of them for $700, and maybe that would cover enough. And you, with if you had 100 cameras in your greenhouse, you could probably still do the same kind of 3D modeling that we're doing from the drone, because you get enough different perspectives to recreate the model.
How long can these drones fly, that little one?
That little one's got a flight time of 7 minutes. And it goes up. The bigger ones can fly for an hour. I think that that doesn't sound like much, but you can collect a lot of data in 7 minutes.
And so I think one of the key challenges is to figure out which data we actually want, so we don't have to spend $300,000 a year to store the data.
That's right. So I think, you know, the reason our data costs are so high is because we're keeping every single bit, because we've got a team of machine learning experts who want to sift through it and figure out what's important. But yeah, once, you know, you can imagine the pipeline, there's big fat, all the raw data comes in, and by the time the actionable data comes out, it's, you know, you could fit it all on your thumb drive for 10 years, because it's just a few numbers a day instead of thousands of gigabytes.
Thank you.